The story is told in the Quran that when God told the angels to bow before the newly created human being, the angels hesitated and objected. And they said, "We are singing your praises in the heavens, and you would create one on earth who will cause bloodshed and strife?" The angels were perplexed. And the divine voice answered, "I know what you do not." The divine knowledge knew that humanity was to become the beneficiary of the divine names, the names of all things. The names of all things were to be given to Adam. Humanity is the custodian of the names. The angels are pre-linguistic, and humanity is called anafsa natiqa, the speaking soul. What is the speech that has been entrusted to us? What is this fruition of logos? There are many names of God. Ultimately, all names are names of God. The 99 are called the Asmal Husna, the most beautiful names. And then there are those names which are called the mothers, Ummahat. And the first of these is Al-Hayy, the living, because life comes first. God could not yet be the knowing without first being the being, the living, the existing. So being comes first. Al-Hayy. But when there is existence, naturally existence must take account of itself. And so Al-Hayy becomes Al-Alim, the knowing. And where there is knowing, there is potency. Knowledge is power. So you could even observe this sequence when you wake up in the morning. Have you ever had the experience of waking up in a dark room during travels and not immediately knowing where you are, and maybe even not yet being quite sure who you are? You wake up in the dark, you don't see yourself, there's no mirror, you don't see your surroundings. You know that you're alive, and that's about all. Then you start to think, "Ah, yes, I'm here. Who am I? Yes, yes, and here I must be in such and such a place. I've traveled here, yes." So the knowledge comes. First of all, just being present, then knowledge, and then, yes, I know where I am. I'm in this bed now. I intend to go down for breakfast, leap off the bed, power. You know you have that prerogative. So, in this way, consciousness unfolds into action, beginning with simple being, then knowing, then acting. Now, suppose you know that you have the potency to act, you go and exercise that potency. You see this in little infants. They discover, the same thing happens with, you see, all of these cycles are reiterated at every level of scale. Waking up in the morning, being born, and growing into childhood. Even the evolution of species. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. So the cycles are all mutually embedded. But you see in infancy, a child is first born and it just feels its existence in the womb and that's all. Then it starts to know itself vis-a-vis the mother. And then at a certain point, it recognizes it can move its limbs, it's got power. And that bowl of mush on the table, it can sweep it and topple it on the ground. And there will be a huge splatter, and the whole world has changed as a result. It has altered the course of history. So that's a stunning discovery. I have power. And of course, at first, it doesn't even matter what the power is for. It's just exercising power. But how long will a baby remain satisfied toppling baby food? Maybe too long for a mother to have patience with, but still not infinitely long. Eventually the baby will find this power has to be used in an interesting way. What do I want? Not just what can I do, but what do I want to do? So then comes al-murid, al-hay, al-alim, al-qadr, powerful, al-murid, the desirous. Desire blossoms in the divine being and in creation, which reflects the divine being, in the growing child that reflects the cosmos. Murid. And then we see also in life that for a certain phase of life, desirousness is the dominant theme. One wants a certain kind of car. One wants a certain kind of attractive person. And so one pursues one's picture of prettiness or handsomeness. But then, so you look out in the world and see who matches one's predisposition. And if someone's face resembles that notion that one has of prettiness, one makes a beeline and starts up a conversation and so forth. And maybe affection flowers, and maybe even there's a romance, but then sooner or later there's a disjunction between one's expectation and the reality. That picture that you have, you're trying to match that picture to someone in the world, but you're just imposing your picture everywhere, and the match might be plausible for a while, but then it proves, no, this is actually a living, breathing human being with his or her own ideas. And that's the point at which then, are you going to be just talking, or are you going to listen? So the next two names are Sami and Basir. So, sami means really listening to what the other person is saying, not just hearing what you hope to hear, but really listening and really seeing. And that's when, in evolution of organisms, you know, this complex sensory apparatus develops more and more. It starts out just, you know, the little microorganisms can sense the blows of other single-celled organisms when they bump into you. But the ability to perceive subtle modulations in voice, and not only to register the syntax of what someone is saying, but the cadences, the ear and brain have developed this tremendous fineness of receptivity, so fine that the ear of a musician hears amazing melodic complexity and intuits the emotions of the composer from those melodies. Likewise, vision. So the human being more and more manifests these divine qualities of hearing and seeing. And only then, after Sami and Basir, comes the culminating of the seven Umahat, the seven leading names, and that is Al-Kalim, the speaker. And that's the speech that comes when one has lived and known one's power and desired and listened and seen. There's a response. You could say that the message of one's life, what is one's voice? The whole of nature is speaking to us. The whole logos is vibrating through the stars, speaking. The message is superabundant. The Quran Sharif says, if all the trees became pens and all of the oceans ink, still that message would not be exhausted. That's the enormity of the divine speech coursing through creation all around us. Now, imagine someone wrote you a letter. And you open up and you see, well, it's a beautiful letter full of kindness, and there's a gift enclosed, and you feel so glad to have it. And then another letter comes and is equally generous. You keep receiving these letters. Well, did one ever think to look on the envelope to see the sender's address? And did one ever consider to write back? That's the nature of our situation in this world. How many messages have you received? Have I received? Personally to me. But it's so easy to wonder why a letter didn't come on a certain day, or get stuck on a certain word in one of the lines. But who's sending this? And then the thought comes, I might answer. It behooves me to answer. That's when life becomes interesting. What is our answer to the Creator? And that's what the human being was taught, to have a voice. So what is your message? Everything that one says is part of one's message. Everything that one says is part of the answer back, whether it's a conscious answer or an unconscious answer. And usually it's an unconscious answer. We are declaring a message. We are inscribing a response. But unwittingly, in everything we say. There's another verse in the Quran which says that every limb, there will come a day when every limb will testify to what it has done. So just imagine the foot will show where it's walked. It'll show all the particular footsteps it took, in which directions, in which places on the earth. Those footprints will all be revealed. And the hand, what did it take? Also, what did it give? All that will be shown. The eyes, where did they go? And the tongue, what did it say? Imagine that day, listening again to all of the words that we've spoken in the course of our life. It's good to think about that day, because it provides a very clear criterion for speech. To speak that which one will be happy to hear again. It's very clear. But then, reflecting on this, we look back and we think, oh dear. How many words I've spoken that I don't want to hear again, that I'll cringe to hear again. In fact, it's precisely that reflection that prevents us from reflecting at all. We don't like to arrive at reflections like that. We don't want to reflect. We'd rather distract ourselves than to sober up. However, by reflecting in this way, we can make a turn. That's what this weekend is about. That's what life's journey offers us, the chance to keep turning, to keep navigating. The story isn't over yet. There's more to be written. This thing can still be turned around. But it means now living attentively, living purposefully, responding to the one that has addressed you. But what about this load of shame that we carry, the mistakes of the past, the things that we've said that were thorns in someone's side or toxins in the air, untruths, profanities, words that concealed rather than revealed reality itself. Those words are still, there's a kind of mist around us. This haze of the record of all that we've said How did we get embroiled in all of this? Well, just as speech is the noble virtue of humanity, deserving of the homage of the angels, speech is also the site of infection. And we've all borne the contagion of forgetfulness, alienation, fear, anger, bitterness, jealousy, envy, all of these distortions of love that flow in the bloodstream of humanity until washed. And so our soul's descent into involvement comes at a heavy price. We're not just spectators here. We're touched by it all. It's not only external to us. The history of humanity is internalized. And in different proportions, in different admixtures. And some souls, it must be said, bear a very heavy burden of inherited pain. But the soul understands this in descending, understands that entering humanity means entering polarity, duality, light and darkness, good and evil, forgetting and remembering, brokenness and wholeness. The soul willingly accepts this and has the chance to either in negligence become another link in the chain of illusory conditioning, which is psychologically imprisoning, by acting out one's woundedness, or healing, and turning anger into forgiveness, breaking the chain. So we're not prisoners of fate. We aren't hopelessly determined by the past. In fact, the more that we clear the past, we understand it, we don't merely act it out, but hold a space of presence, unravel the knots and the binds, open up spaciousness, commune with the cosmos, and through the cosmos with the divine light pervading all. The cycle of enmity, the spirit of agitation that waswas al-khanas, that grim old whisper in the ear of humanity, can be exorcised. Suppose one builds no cathedral, One writes no magnum opus, and at the end of one's life, one is forgotten. But in the course of one's life, one has imbibed toxins, and through one's days, one has remediated them, composted them, made the stuff of new growth from them. Never mind fame or fortune, if one has entered this world, cleared a space, given love in answer to love disguised and contorted in fear and bitterness, then one has shared in a great current that runs through this world. This great stream of Rahma, this great flow of loving kindness. And more in that stream will come the voice that is to articulate one's soul. Maybe you found yourself sometimes struggling to find words. You feel something, you want to convey something. Someone is there to listen, but you're circumambulating the point. But at last, the extraneous words fall away. The clear theme comes into focus. Just the right words land upon your tongue, and you say what you want to say. That's where we are moving to in life. And the logos that brings us there is this wind of generosity, this great current of Rahma. Trying to cast our sails to catch that wind amidst adverse waters. This is the work, to find the words, to let go of all of the extraneous words. On that day when the tongue will testify to what it is said, perhaps one will be most sorry to hear again all of the static. But here and there within the static are these moments. So our work now can be to abandon the unnecessary, abandon all of the prolixity, verbosity. Go to the point. We don't have so long here on earth. What do we really want to say? What are the words that convey it? And find your own voice, because the great voices, each is unique, all one message, but like the different keys of a piano, each sounding its note. So we can be inspired by inspiring voices. But in the end, every inspiration must lead us to our own authentic voice. You cannot speak on behalf of anyone else. And the truer your voice, the more resounding your voice, the more that it bespeaks your true experience. What is your essential experience? What is growing? What is showing itself? What is revealing itself in your life? That's the root of your voice. And if your voice isn't conveying that, if it's conveying secondary influences, you're echoing what you've heard, it isn't yet the inner message of your soul's journey. Now, some say, "Well, I've stumbled and fallen into the ditch, and I'm so." Bogged down in guilt and bad habits that there's no real recourse. But no, that is defeatism. The path is always there. Just because, Murshid said, just because you have stepped into the ditch doesn't mean you must continue to walk there. Step out. So, words misspoken. Untruths, harsh gossip, you know, the ways that we, when people aren't present, speak of them deridingly because they're not there to hear it. Well, somehow they hear it. And the derision keeps whirling. Whatever we say, it keeps whirling. Has a life of its own. It lives on. So that whirl, that residue, yes, just because one has misspoken, there is a residue, but it's possible to make a turn, and that turn will heal. The past can be healed. The past can be transformed by an act of will. When it's sincere. Sincere understanding and repentance for having done wrong. The tear of that awareness is the most pure, most sweet thing in this world. That's the nectar of the heavens. A tear of genuine contrition and the readiness now to go another way. There's a jubilation in the heavens. In fact, Amir Minai said, so magnificent is the forgiveness of my Lord that not to sin is a sin of a sort. You follow? That is to say that the sweetest aspect of love is not only the love that naturally attaches itself to what is perfect But the love that redeems what is imperfect and persists with it and reaches out to it and takes it unto itself. That forgiving, accepting, uplifting love, that is so definitive of the divine nature, that if there were no sin, God in some sense could not be God in the fullest sense. Divinity shows itself in this forecomingness that goes out into the broken world and lifts it up. If there were no brokenness, if there were no distancing, no error, there could be not this delicacy of reunion, this sweetest tryst. Let that be a consolation when one looks back. It's not a justification, it's not an excuse. One must certainly, in recognizing one's errors, endeavor to learn and grow. But to see how the divine love holds it all, as a loving mother absorbs both the mischief and the gentleness of the child. But let's not be lulled into complacency. So we have to have that balance. It's a delicate balance. If we are too stoically self-driven, then we haven't acknowledged the infinitude of the forgiveness of God. We've reduced God to a loveless judge. On the other hand, if we see only the divine Jamal and not the divine Jalal, if we acknowledge only God's loving forgiveness and all-encompassing generosity and not the duty that is owed to being itself, the sober conscientiousness that marks responsibility. If we have no care for the consequences of actions and only consign ourselves to the hope of being forgiven, there is exaggeration. So the path is this delicate balance. Murshid said, "Do not fear God, but carefully regard God's pleasure." So when we look over the past, yes, if we obsess about our misdeeds, well, those misdeeds, in fact, then recur in our minds and are reified and tend to proliferate. On the other hand, if we're just reckless and heedless and go along creating turmoil everywhere, there will be a reckoning. So, the balance. Look back, learn, but look ahead. Whatever one has truly grown from, it's yielded a harvest. But But that which one keeps mindlessly doing again and again without learning, it's a mania. So a mistake is not really a mistake. The repetition of a mistake is a mistake. The first mistake is a revelation. But failing to heed the revelation, then one errs. No doubt we will continue to make mistakes, but let them be new mistakes. Let's not make the same old mistakes. Shall we close our eyes and let's think of the whole record of our words, written, spoken. Do you feel prepared right now to resolve to ensure that what one says conveys the real message of one's life? To speak honestly doesn't mean to speak obsequiously and flatteringly. One can to speak kindly doesn't require to be obsequious and flattering in all instances. One can be kind and honest. Likewise, to be honest doesn't mean to be blunt and harsh. One can be kind and honest. Choose one's words wisely. And when in doubt, don't speak. One is never compelled to speak, rarely, if ever. Can always postpone, go into silence. Don't speak until you have the command of your words so that you can say what you really mean to say. How do you know if you're about to speak unwisely? You know because your breath is already out of rhythm. That's the sign. So when we practice our breathing exercises, we're familiarizing ourselves with that rhythm that we've got to expect before acting. But then are you prepared to determine now, to resolve now, that henceforth, going forward, speaking with friends, someone is mentioned, and described unkindly, and there's a gleeful pouncing upon a perceived error or shortcoming in that person. Now, there might be the temptation to join in the fun, but do any of us wish to do that? And could anything good come of it? And might we not always instead, whenever we speak of anyone, speak of him or her as if he or she was right there? So Are we ready to resolve that in our minds now that, yes, henceforth, that is my intention when I speak of someone, not to imagine that spatial distance is a justification for calumny. And also, then, can we decide now that even though there are times when I could gain an advantage, a personal advantage, by being less than straightforward in what I say, skirting around some part of the truth, emphasizing something while concealing other relevant facts, persuading someone of something because that persuasion benefits me, but I know I am conniving. Are we prepared to say we won't do that? And that even in subtle ways, when the temptation is there, we'll resist that temptation. Just be simple, be straightforward, be clear. Are we resolved upon that? So there's certain resolutions that if we can make them, make it very clear what is our mandate in speaking. And then the message of our speech will become clearer and clearer. The static, the confusion will dissipate. We'll say what we mean, we'll mean what we say. And the old grime, the misspoken words, the luminous energy that comes with clear, beautiful speech has a cleansing effect upon the mouth and even disinfects the old oral wounds. And we can prepare for this resolution by doing something which comes in the form of a practice which has come down the ages. And that is this, that one places one's fingers on the lips and feel that the misspoken words of the past, the untruths and unkindnesses, are drawn out of the teeth and tongue and lips into the fingertips. And you say, La ilaha. As you say, La ilaha, you reach out with your hands toward the sky and spread your fingers and feel that the darkness, the murk is dissipating, dissolving into the light of the heavens. And then feel your fingertips kindled to incandescence by the light of the heavens, and bring your hands down to your lips, and again place your fingers on your lips, and now feel the burning benediction of light on the tongue. As in the Pentecostal story of the tongues of flame. The mouth is purified and ignited. That we bring our hands down as we say, Illallahu. So we'll do this a few times. I'm clearing out the grime and drawing down light. But we can only do this if we are really sincere in our intention now to dedicate our tongue to kindness and truth. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah. Once more, la ilaha illallah. In a comic strip, when a character speaks, there's a bubble overhead, and so the words are printed in the sky. And when a character thinks but doesn't speak, still there's a bubble. There's not so much difference. In the one case, below the bubble are little bubbles. In the other case, there's a little jagged line. But in both cases, something is inscribed above the head. There's not so much difference, you see, in a cartoon between what a character says and what a character thinks. And that conveys a real truth. Because everything that we say, we've thought. And thinking is another way of saying. We just don't say it verbally, but it's said in the mind. And at the level of the mind, it's audible. Someone who is very attentive, very keen, can actually hear what another person is thinking. And even if he or she doesn't hear it consciously, quite probably she hears it unconsciously. So those words, those paragraphs are there, our thoughts, and that itself is a message. Even if we don't, if we stop saying untruths, stop speaking unkind words, but we might still think them, and that still is an emanation of our being that enters the universe at its particular level. So the first step is to take responsibility for what is audibly said. But once that's under control, one can start to reckon with what is inaudibly said, what is said in the mind, what one thinks. Now you might ask, well, but who is the censor? Is there going to be an authority figure in the mind that's censoring not only the things I say, but my very thoughts will be policed? Yes, well, our concern is a fair one. We have a natural respect for liberty and don't want a dictatorial regime internalized within our own mind. And in fact, there is a tendency within what is called the nafsa lawama in its distortion to become a censor that condemns illicit thoughts. But of course, the condemnation of unwanted thoughts isn't necessarily helpful, because what is censored is just repressed and pushed down, and it pops up elsewhere or festers in the darkness, in the unconscious. So it's not practical. When a thought arises that is deemed unacceptable, to push it down, how then do we work? First of all, who is the internal judge? We've got to be careful that the authority is not this conditioned, repressed and repressive superego that is a byproduct of social conditioning. We've got to be careful that the voice of conscience is conscience itself, and conscience meaning the fullness of our human experience speaking, incorporating all dimensions of what it means to live this life, from the physical to the spiritual, from body to soul, the whole sum of one's life, what is good in the wholeness of being, responsive to what is good in the wholeness of the cosmos. That's the best way we can understand the good. Whatever is good only for some little part benefits a fragment at the expense of the larger system, the larger totality, sooner or later proves deleterious. But that which is symbiotically good, that which is cosmically good, there's the sign, there's the criterion, that which serves wholeness. So with that criterion then, suppose thoughts rise up that are habitual, broodings laden with fear and anger and shame and so forth, or just withering, cynical glances directed at other people. Those things, if we, first of all, normally we don't even see it happening, we're just in the grip of it. But then if we see it, now there's a chance. All right, I see this is some conditioned, habitual mental activity going on. then what do? Do you just push it down, deny yourself that thought? That won't get you very far. So then one has to, there's a certain energy in the mind, one has to either rechannel it, open up its channel, bring light to it, show a further, a higher direction. Like suppose an old Sufi technique is someone is, one of the features of addiction to cigarettes is to like to have something in your hand. So you replace the cigarette with a tasbih. So it's one way of working. You take a line of thought and start to redirect it in a different direction. You have to recognize that impetus is already there, but you can work creatively with it. Another way is to dig down into it. Where is it coming from? What's it rooted in? What's the need? What's the fear? Instead of just acting it out, which has become redundant and extremely banal, when the same thought, the gloomy thought, just keeps recurring. But really, what's underlying it? What's at stake? What's the need? So in this way, one starts to inquire within oneself. This is the way Moshe advises, fashioning the self. When some voice lifts itself up in your mind, all too often the whole psyche just chases after it and you just act it out, whatever it is. But if you can introduce an interval of pause and say, well, what is this voice? What is it calling for? What are the reasons for it? What's it rooted in? What's the end game? Where is it all going? You know, this kind of inner understanding of yourself and your motives and seeing how you have different motives, which are often at cross purposes. How do you disentangle them and see the big picture? This is the whole work of self-awareness. So it begins with developing responsibility for one's speech, but then it goes on to the mind. Watching, not just thinking, but watching yourself think. But one has to watch oneself gently. One has to watch with a certain foundation of self-respect. Otherwise, one will be anxiously racking one's brain and despairing. But if one feels that, yes, this mind is malleable, I've taken on certain habits of mind, there are even biological components to what's going through my mind that I have to reckon with, but I am attendant to the process, patient, ready to listen to whatever is arising, observe it, create an interval between thought and action, and dwell in the thought. Look for where is the horizon. Where is the frontier of meaning? Where clarity is coming, where purpose is coming. And keep orienting in that direction. Even if you're bogged down in difficult terrain, keep going through it step by step, but the orientation is important. The oriens in Latin, the orient, the place of the rising sun, where clarity comes from. Plotinus said, the sage is the one who in the dead of night sits in the darkness and cannot lift up the sun, but knows the eastern horizon toward which to turn. Turn toward the Orients. It's time for another break. We'll have a quick one, 15 minutes, and then come back for one last gathering.
Could I see Annalie Smith, please? So, friends, we have a short time for a bathroom break. Actually, we have...